Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So the problem that we have with our podcast sometimes is that one of us, and it's not me, does a lot of traveling because a lot of people around the world would like to know his thoughts on various matters revolving around sports science. And that, of course, is Professor Ross Tucker, who is back in South Africa after 3 weeks of traveling around the world and doing some speakers and hanging out with some of the big names in the world of opinion. we'll get into that a bit more detail in a bit of time. But Ross, just give us an idea where you were. I know that you were in the UK for a while, then you went off to Boston.
Yeah, the main point was Boston. I was invited to attend the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, which is held there every year. Well, it's the first time since 20, maybe 19, actually. They might have just been cut off by COVID in 20. But anyway, it was the first time back for them. And they were running a panel on transgender athletes in sport. And I got this email last year and I thought, I don't know if I feel like this. But then I got a follow-up email from Malcolm Gladwell saying, we'd really love it if you'd come. I'm hosting this panel. So I thought, well,
I better go.
I must go because I wanted to meet him and see what it was like. So anyway, in the end, they made it happen. We made it happen together and off I went. And so there was a panel with, he was chairing. I was on it. Joanna Harper, who's a scientist who's now doing a PhD on this issue in England. Mm-hmm. She was, she's a trans woman herself and was very involved in the early days of IOC policy around this issue. So her initial study formed the basis for the policy we'll no doubt talk about shortly. And then the third member of the panel was Katie Barnes, who's a journalist with ESPN and is writing a book on this issue. Now, Joanna and Katie both support inclusion of trans athletes in sport. And so I was outnumbered on stage and it was, and maybe we'll get into it if you want. I left it feeling very frustrated. I was kicking myself for weeks afterwards, literally, at lost opportunities to say certain things and respond. And I realized some things during that session is that I don't know how much more someone like me can contribute to this discussion because it has changed. There was a time a year ago where the trans woman in sport discussion was about data. Mm. And ironically enough, I mean, I was just got an email from Sloan the other day. They're about to release the video of that session because they do this so you can watch it and see why I was kicking myself. But they called it a conversation led by Malcolm Gladwell on data and participation policy. There was no data in the session. We couldn't get to it. And I think Malcolm Gladwell wanted it. But every time he asked a question, neither Joanna nor Katie wants to speak about data. And of course, all I want to do is talk about data.
When you talk about data, are you talking about the science of the subject rather than the emotion behind it?
I'm trying to, yes. And I mean, I'm not dispassionate about it to the point that I don't care about the emotion. In fact, just the opposite. Mm. If I was that dispassionate, I'd have left this thing alone a long time ago. Because it's actually a pain. It really annoys me. And you know what I realized? One of the few realizations was that same morning. It was Saturday morning, first Saturday in March, which was the day of Strada Bianchi. So did you watch the women's finish?
Yes, fantastic.
It was miles better than the men's. The men's race was so boring.
Absolutely.
Like, men's cycling makes me uncomfortable at the moment, but that's another
time. Really cheering for Ashley Moorman-Passio, our South African rider at that point.
So we had her involved, but even without her there, I mean, the finish was just like breathtakingly good. Mm. It was one of the best sports finishes you'll ever see in any sport. It was fantastic.
Oh, the last 20Ks were incredible in the women's race.
It was amazing. Yeah. And so I watched that morning because now I'm six hours behind. So I finished watching that and off I go now. And what am I going to go and do is talk about this issue in women's sports. What a waste. Like, I'd far rather talk about that type of thing.
Yeah, a celebration of
women's
sport.
What's the physiology of Lotte Kopecky, right? Mm. And Van Vleuten. And Moorman-Passio. Mm. Now, let's talk about the physiology and the growth of women's cycling to the point that it produces that. Women's rugby is the same. Could talk for hours about concussion in women's rugby and the growth of the game and what's being done and so on. But no, instead I've got to get up there and talk about males in women's sport. It just is so annoying.
Is it frustrating? And we've been down this path, and of course we talked about this issue on past podcasts. But is it frustrating because you feel like the data and the science supports the most logical decision, and nobody seems to be listening, and there are still people with voices that are still there despite the evidence? I mean, what gets you about this issue?
Yeah, that's the main thing. So, for example, I understand that there will be advocates on both sides.
Hmm.
Who are not interested in data. They're advocates for their positions. And for them, it's only about emotion. And I mean, I've spoken to some fairly balanced, middle-of-the-road people since that, and doctors and so on, and they're very sympathetic towards trans individuals. They say, imagine what it must be like to feel like you're in this body that's not... And if that's a genuine feeling and concern, which it is in a lot of them, that must be very difficult. I mean... Everyone's dealt with people who are going through things, but that must be really difficult. So
sure.
You want to be sympathetic and understand that if that's the side they're arguing for, then me coming there with my physiological data, they're not interested in. Like, why are you in my way?
Yeah.
And then on the other side, there are people who are defending women's spaces and who have every right to do that and become more and more aggressive in the opposite direction. And in the end, it's actually a very vitriolic fight. So that part of it's frustrating because a big part of me wants to try and solve the problem, you know, not take a side, Solomonically.
Yeah.
Solomon's wisdom here. Let's cut the baby in half. But okay, we can't.
Yeah.
So that's the frustrating bit. And then the other part of it is how many sensible people seem to just overlook the data. It's so obvious to me. And I see sports scientists, colleagues, other people who I've worked with in the past. Someone tweeted the other day, imagine waking up every morning and you've got many followers on Twitter and real influence around the world, and all you want to go and do is keep trans women out of women's sport. I don't know if he was directing that at me, but I'm like, piss off. So excuse my language, but like, how arrogant are you to tell other people what should matter to them and tell them they're wrong about it at the same time? Two birds of, like, so that sort of stuff really gets, after a while, it gets to you. And
do you have moments when you... I mean, you obviously do hear these arguments, and you've dealt with it for more than a year or so, probably longer. And when you have discussions and panel discussions like you've done, are there moments where you think, maybe I need to rethink this or look closely? How, I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that the science speaks the truth?
No, not really. I mean, of course, everyone should always at some point question their positions. So I do that often. Every time I question the science and the physiology, I'll kind of land in the same place. So until such time as there's a new discovery, that's not going to change. But what I do, so at this conference, Katie Barnes made what I think was a fair point about how we have a scarcity mindset. And if we could change that, then we might be able to find ways to be inclusive without compromising women's sport. Because for those... the uninitiated, the big problem is that women's sport exists for a reason. That reason is fairness and safety for biological females who don't have the capacity or the ceiling that testosterone creates. And so we have closed off a space for them in sport so that we can celebrate Katie Ledecky and Michael Phelps as equal, even though their performance levels are different. We can celebrate Serena Williams and Nadal, Federer, Djokovic as equals, even though in a one-on-one matchup, and Williams has said this herself, she'd lose 6-1, 6-love in 5 minutes. Those are her words. Yet she's still the greatest tennis player we've seen, maybe, across both, but certainly woman. Why? Because she has a closed space. So it doesn't matter how you frame it and who you pick to represent the argument. Women's sport exists to create equal reward for equal humans, even though they're different in performance. Right?
Yeah.
So sorry, why am I waffling about this? That's the root cause. If we break that boundary and we allow the infiltration, whether it's small numbers or large, of biological males with this higher capacity, we compromise that women's sport integrity. Now, in elite sport, it is a zero-sum game. There are only 8 lanes in the Olympic final. There are only 8 lanes in a swimming pool. There are only 11 spots on the football team. Well, 15, 16, would have plus subs, right? It's a squad. There's only 5 players going to start in a basketball match. So the moment you have selection in a merit-based system, that whole system starts to fade. And whether it's, you know, one person or 100 doesn't really matter. It's conceptually the same thing. So, sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. So with elite sport, it's quite clear that you're trying to protect something that's necessary and rational to protect. On the other hand, you do say, okay, well, what harm would it do if it happened where there wasn't selection and where we didn't have limited numbers of spaces? Could we facilitate a sporting world where it wasn't so brutal and capitalistic? And, you know, and as parents listening to this, even without the trans issue, this is true, right? Like once Paul gets selected for the A team, but Tim doesn't, Tim's sporting career might be over at 13.
Yeah.
There's no way back.
Yeah.
So is there a better way to do sport? And that's the point that Katie Barnes made. And I'm thinking about this. Well, maybe there is. I wouldn't change the whole structure of sport just because of trans women.
No.
But there could be a better way. And then I find myself thinking about, I never want to compromise on the zero-sum nature of elite sport, competitive sport. It's not just elite, right? It's scholarship selections from high school into colleges. It's selection into state or provincial or regional teams, whatever else. It's not just elite Olympic we're talking about.
But it's right through the whole,
because the whole system is interconnected. You know, what happens at the Olympic level can be traced back to something that happened at 15-16, rightly or wrongly. That's how it works. So then I found myself thinking, I wonder if there's a better way we can do this to not be as brutally exclusive without being inclusive to the point of unfairness. But the more I'm involved in it, the more I think I go the other way. And so that's a tension.
So the only thing, and just to make it clear what we're talking about, I think for those of you who have not listened to our previous podcasts on this issue, when we talk about trans athletes, we're talking about athletes who, in this particular instance, talking about men who became women through sex changes for a variety of reasons. They then participate in sport as women, and the evidence and the science so far and the studies that have been done so far suggest that there is a hangover benefit of being previously male that gives you a benefit now that you're female, which no matter how many hormones you take or suppress, you're still going to have an advantage just in terms of muscle, for instance, muscle capacity.
So in a number of physiological systems that are relevant to performance, muscle mass, muscle size, muscle strength, body fat, heart and lung size, testosterone creates things that are never fully undone. There's only one system or attribute that's been shown to be fully reversed, and that's hemoglobin. Males have high levels of hemoglobin, and with testosterone suppression, within about 4 months, that drops to the female range. And so that's almost completely reversed. But none of the others.
So men have more hemoglobin than women?
Yeah, by about 15-20%.
Wow.
And it drops very quickly, actually, within a few months.
Do we know why that is the case? That's interesting, because you often think about just muscle mass as the difference, but you're talking about even on a blood level there's a difference.
Right, and I don't know the molecular mechanism for it. Yeah. Testosterone's obviously getting into DNA, switching on genes, then, and as a consequence of that, there's some synthesis of red blood cells that is amplified. So
that's interesting.
All other systems, though, from the skeleton, which can't change at all, I mean, you never get shorter, your hands never get smaller, your legs never get shorter, your arms, they stay the same. And then including muscle mass. So where for instance, you see differences in between male and female of, say, 30 to 40% for power, for strength, for muscle mass, testosterone suppression for a year takes away 5 to 10%. And so the result is quite a large retained advantage. And if you have that retained biological advantage, then you have retained performance advantages. And so that's known because there have been now 13 different studies that have been published on trans women showing that. So you say that to people and then they say, well, hang on, those studies aren't on elite athletes. Okay, what would happen if they were elite athletes? What do you think? Okay, and they never say what, but they should.
Yeah.
You've got an obligation. If you're going to challenge the science, then at least hypothesize what will happen next.
Yeah.
And the thing is, We can make reasonable estimates, not guesses, but we can predict what might happen, because we know, for instance, that in men who suppress testosterone because they have prostate cancer, it's been shown that if they do strength training while they're suppressing the testosterone, they don't lose any muscle mass at all. So in fact, lots of places around the world, prostate cancer treatment involves prescribed strength training so that you don't lose muscle mass. So actually, with training, you probably have less loss than without.
Yeah.
There have been studies that have suppressed testosterone in males, and you can certainly build muscle mass as a testosterone-suppressed male. And then we know that in general concept in physiology is that whatever it took to get you to point X is not required to stay at point X. You know, if you had to train for a certain period and in certain volumes and intensities to get to your performance level, you can stay there on slightly less than it took to get there. You know, you have this maintenance of detraining and protection against it. So again, all the evidence suggests that if I suppress testosterone and keep training and I'm trained before, I'll actually be protected against the loss, which means more retained advantage.
Yeah.
And now what's happening, of course, is that slowly but surely, the prediction that the science makes is coming true. Because, and this is, by the way, that argument I just made about the interconnectedness of sport and a zero-sum game and how the Olympics are connected to the high school through a pathway, that came up in the debate. Because Jonah Harper and Katie Barnes are making the argument that at school level, and unless there's money and records involved, we shouldn't have exclusion. We should just be inclusive. And I'm saying, well, no, because there's 8 lanes in the pool at the NCAA finals. One of those lanes to a trans woman means one not to a woman.
Yeah.
Anyways, I didn't make them like this, though. This is why I'm frustrated. And the other thing that I didn't get across well.
This is quite cathartic for you in a way, isn't it?
It's very therapeutic. Thanks, Dr. Phil. What was I saying before I interrupted myself?
You were talking about the fact that these are things that you wanted to say around the
Malcolm,
fact that
Malcolm Gladwell said, you know, there's this saying like that hard cases make bad law. Have you heard that before? Like, you know, it's a difficult case and you try and write law and that makes. And I did point this out, but not strongly enough, is these examples of trans women who are now succeeding at the highest level, like Laurel Hubbard competing in the Olympics for New Zealand in weightlifting, like Leah Thomas, who's swimming this weekend. I'm not sure when this podcast goes out, but has or will be swimming in the NCAA swimming championships. They're not hard cases that make bad law. They are the manifestation of the bad policy. Because 2 years ago, you could have looked at the policies around trans women and then held the science next to them. The science that says that advantages are retained. And you could have said, based on this science and these policies, I predict Leah Thomas within the next 2 years. And sure enough, here we are.
Yeah.
Because if you retain those advantages and you're even a half decent swimmer, like Leah Thomas was as Will Thomas 3 years ago. Now, Will Thomas was ranked, and I looked at this ahead of Boston's, that's how I know the numbers, 32nd in the USA in men's swimming in the 1650 yards. And 552nd or 51st in the 200-yard event is now number one in both. Because with testosterone suppression, Leah Thomas is swimming 2.6% slower over 200 yards and 5.5% slower over the 1650. Now, the male-female difference is 8 to 12%. So if you slow down by 2 or 5%, you're going to move up. Yeah. Because you've slowed down by less than the difference of the category difference between you, right? Makes sense.
Yeah.
So obviously she's going to get better rankings. And sure enough, number one in the country. Now, at NCAAs, maybe some swimmers will peak and Leah Thomas won't win. Which means by Monday morning, I'm going to be told on Twitter that because Leah Thomas didn't win, there can't be an advantage.
But even if she finishes fourth, she's still potentially disadvantaging the person who finished fifth.
Correct. Yeah. And third means denying a medal.
Yeah.
And the finishing position doesn't tell you about the advantage. Honestly, I mean, you asked what's frustrating. This is an example of a frustrating argument. She's not winning, therefore there can't be an advantage. What's the problem? Well, some of these people should walk, like it's like they walk around with a giant sandwich board saying, I'm an idiot, written on them. You can't judge advantage based on the final position. It has to be pre-post.
It's the principle of it more than anything.
Yeah, we always joke when we're cycling, like I wish I had an e-bike to get up this climb 5 minutes faster. I still wouldn't win the Tour de France. Does that mean my e-bike doesn't give me an advantage? Of course not. It's so stupid to make that case. But that's the kind of thing that'll happen now if Thomas doesn't win. But of course, if she does win, then 20% more people take notice.
But I can imagine within that space of NCAA swimming in the States at the moment, there must be a fair amount of controversy that sits around this space. So, you know, there are obviously those who are for and those that are against, but as we saw with Lauren Hubbard, there was a lot of controversy around that. And particularly coming, I'd imagine, from women's groups, because it is about protection of sports. So
it's gotten, in the last 2 months since Thomas, well, it was actually almost like November, December last year that Thomas first started registering these performances. The conversation has, I mean, it's exponentially more intense than it used to be.
Mm.
Because parents of these kids in these NCAA schools are now starting to take notice and find a voice. The media started to cover it. And I mean, like Sports Illustrated did a whole cover article on Leah Thomas, talking about all the disadvantages and how difficult it is. And you look at this and you say, like, how can you not understand that this is a colliding rights issue? You know, this is an issue where, you know, I'm resorting to all the cliches now. My right to swing my arm through the air ends where your face starts. Have you heard that one?
No, but it's a good one.
So like, that's what this is. Like, we all have every right to identify how we please and live as we please. But when that right starts to infringe on other rights, we have to change the way we assess this discussion. And in this particular conversation, how can you cover it without acknowledging women's arguments also? And that's the other frustrating thing, is that so many people seem only to say take one side of this, you know? So
was the Sports Illustrated story about the battle that she has to, and well, the person has to go under, and so we're sympathetic to her as an athlete?
Yeah, extremely.
Really?
And there's a paragraph or two there about some argue that Thomas shouldn't be allowed to compete because they suggest that there are advantages. No. Not some argue and suggest that. Evidence shows that, and until proven otherwise, this means unfairness. And we've said now, World Rugby was at this point in 2019, early 2020, was inclusion and fairness do not coexist based on everything we currently know. You pick one or the other, and the media try and make it out that those who say that are fringe. And then, of course, you get the transphobia allegations. And it's extremely poisonous. Mm. And what's happening now is like that it's become so aggressive that even people on the same side are hurling insults at one another.
Mm.
Because, for instance, and I've done this a couple times, is when we talk about Leah Thomas, should we say she or he?
Yeah.
Because Leah Thomas's chosen pronouns are she. Now, if I'm going to say my right to swing my hand through space ends where your face starts, like, calling Leah Thomas she isn't, in theory, affecting anything.
Mm.
But women's groups, and they've got a point, argue that when we change the meaning of words, then we start to lose the battle. So now there's this whole debate about pronouns. And so my Twitter timeline is full of people who, there's a website called Swimming World, run by a guy called John Lone, who's been one of the few media guys who's quite outspoken about unfairness in this case. And a couple times a week is writing updates on Thomas, and every single time writes the scientific, objective view that Thomas has unfair advantages over other swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
But John Lone has made the choice to say she when he talks about Thomas, and he gets piled on. So actually it's like, I get it. I understand why you want to defend the pronouns she and he and call Leah Thomas he. Mm. But at some point, you're going to put John Lone off doing what he's doing, because you're actually criticizing your own.
Yeah.
He's on your side. Yeah. Give him a break. You know, like when we had our meeting, we would not have gotten those people into the room if we'd refused to recognize their own pronouns for the World Rugby Group. If we hadn't made certain concessions to be like decent at their request, we would never even have had a policy. It would have been stillborn.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In fact,
let's just talk about, I mean, World Rugby, obviously you're very involved in World Rugby. What is the moment? It's guidelines, isn't it, in terms of trans, not rules.
Right, and that's because different places around the world have different legislative frameworks and contexts. And so World Rugby can't tell Canada what they must do legally. So we have a guideline that they can then choose to implement or not. And many countries chose not to implement it because they're going the same way out of fear. One of the unions we worked with said, we think you're right and we totally actually agree with you, but we're not going to do it because the backlash will be so huge. And so we don't want to take that risk. That's
a political hedgehog, isn't it?
So it's exactly like, and then
nobody wants to
others
catch
have
it.
Said, oh, the evidence is not strong enough. Okay, well then fine. Have males play women's rugby based on the fact there's not enough evidence. Mm-hmm. But then go to your next meeting to talk about not letting 16-year-olds play with 14-year-olds. There's no evidence for that. It's the same thing.
Were there any questions from the floor when you did this debate?
No, we didn't have time. Uh-huh. And it was a lively debate, and it was very respectful and decent. And so I think that's and I want, coming back to something I brought up earlier, I then was in Johannesburg. There was a sports medicine conference up here, and I was talking to a guy who's now the senior editor of a very big sports science journal about this issue, because I spoke about this at the conference. And he was saying that he feels, as an editor, like that he's caught in the middle of a crossfire here between two rival gangs, and they are so aggressive towards one another that he actually doesn't want to entertain the argument because he doesn't see enough dialogue to actually make it even constructive. So this is an example where the emotion is actually detracting from the potential for progress, because if the two sides would just settle and listen to one another, I think they would find 5% overlap, which might open the door to the 95% disagreement and potential, not, I don't think there's resolutions, again, like we can't cut the baby in half, but he was of the opinion that if we could find ways to bring people together instead of opposed, then he would listen more. And because he'd be prepared to listen more, I think with knowledge and education, he would recognize more the merits of the argument around fairness trumping inclusion in terms of priorities and the fact that they can't coexist, you see. But the moment it's as vitriolic as it is, I think a lot of people who think they're being decent actually pick the side because they just don't want to deal with the potential backlash, bigotry, right?
Yeah.
So we've created...
I mean, you've even seen that in rugby when you set out the guidelines, that there are various federations around the world who actually said, well, we're not going to follow that because they are worried about the backlash of it.
They're extremely concerned. And I mean, some of them are well-meaning and some of them are not. Some of them have, in my opinion, abandoned women's rights. They've forgotten that this is a colliding right. You know, they've only seen a fist swinging through the air. They haven't seen a face that it's about to impact. And then the other thing that's really bad that's happening a lot is Leah Thomas, dozens of times a day, he's a cheat, just wants to win in women's sports, just wants to get into women's change rooms and see naked women. Now, I don't know Leah Thomas at all. I don't know any of the trans individuals, but I think when we reduce it to he's cheating or he's a pervert and he just wants to like compete, the only reason Leah Thomas identifies as trans is to win at sport or to get into women's change rooms. I think that does a disservice to the discussion. Right. And unfortunately, that voice is being amplified by Thomas. It's hysteria. So Gladwell asked a question. It's a very astute question of the panelists. He said, does the existence and the performance of a Leah Thomas at the elite level make it more difficult for the trans agenda at the community level? And the answer absolutely is yes, because by failing to protect in the zero sum environment, it's not the elite level, it's NCAA schools, college level, Ivy League level, by failing to ensure that protection for women, sport has allowed this debate to be put out into the mainstream, where frankly a lot of people aren't responsible enough to have it, or sensible enough, and not, or kind enough and decent enough. So it's very difficult. It's
I suppose there are extremists on both sides of the argument, but
there are, and
especially when people don't feel, you feel frustrated. I imagine on the other side of the argument, there are people that feel equally as frustrated.
Well, exactly, and that's why I get it a lot from again. I sometimes, I don't know, maybe we're going to get it for this podcast using she, not he. But fine, whatever. Like, fine, you have your opinion. You go fight it your way. I'll try and do this my way, and that's with the data and so on. And to bring it back full circle, we're at the sports analytics conference. We did not get the opportunity to talk data. You know what I said to you about 30-40% difference in power and strength. Leah Thomas 2.6% slower now, and therefore gone from. We didn't even get a chance to say that stuff. Yeah. And it's kind of important.
Yeah, that's important.
And you'd think a room full of data analysts and analytical types, that would be the. But no, we got We got pulled into community arguments, inclusion. You know, these trans women, they just want to be part of something. They want to be part of a team. I get that. But so do women. So I relate more to one side than the other, for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm deeply uncomfortable at the toxicity and the shouting that's now happening. And I'm just mostly depressed at the fact that, like, so many cool women's, it's Cricket World Cup right now, right? And I wake up every morning, I'm watching our women, unbeaten so far, and it's fantastic. And it's great.
Good games, like, to watch. Cricket, I've watched a few.
Women's Cricket World Cup now is at the level the men's was like 10, 15 years ago. It's still on a steep upward trajectory. Like, that would be cool to celebrate. But no, no one wants to hear. If I tweet about women's cricket, I'll get one like and two retweets. And one other comment saying stick to, you know what I mean? Like, but if you tweet about trans stuff, hundreds, thousands of engagements. And it's I'm tired of it.
But as you mentioned right at the start of the podcast, when you talk about the cycling, I mean, women's cycling has come up in leaps and bounds in the last 5 or 6 years, where they've been given TV time in collaboration with the men's events happening at the same time, really getting to know the women's athletes. So that sport has been protected, but has now got the same level of, maybe not the same level, but has got much more interest than it ever has.
Massively.
Because they're getting the exposure and people appreciate watching a good women's race.
Yeah, and it's still far behind. Remember last year there was controversy.
But it still makes a good race.
When Lizzie won Paris-Roubaix for women, and someone compared prize money, and it's comical, the difference. So yeah, they're getting good races, they're on TV, they got pro teams, fantastic. But now it must kick on. And every conversation that's had about this issue is like one conversation less that could be had about the merits of women's sport.
For sure.
And I'd far rather talk about that. So I'm not saying that I'm going to stop talking about this, because this is obviously important. And and if you want to develop women's sport, I think the prerequisite is you must protect it, its meaning. And its meaning is woman only. It's pretty basic. But also, I just, like, I can't even bear to, like, look at my Twitter timeline. I just, it's so demoralizing, you know? Really terrible.
Let's get off the subject. I know that you've probably spoken about this ad nauseum for the last 3 weeks or so, but thank you very much for that interesting insight, because I think it is interesting to see, as we've discussed it on this podcast before, but then to see what the global view is. The fact that there are people such as Malcolm Gladwell hosting talks on this shows the interest there is in it, even though the decision and the thoughts should be fairly simple.
So speaking of, one last thing, two last things on that. Malcolm Gladwell's first question at the conference is, let's do this from basics. And Gladwell, like, I've criticized him in the past, and maybe he's listening to this, but I was, my biggest regret from Boston, aside from my sort of insipid performance in the debate, was that I didn't get to spend more time with him, because he arrived like 15 minutes before the panel started, and then he left straight after because he had commitments either side. So, and in those 25 minutes, all we spoke about was track and field. He is a nut for track and field.
He's quite a good runner, isn't he?
He's very good. I mean, he used to be really good. He said to me, his biggest regret is that he doesn't know how fast he could have been if he tried harder and applied himself, because he was beating guys who are now in the Olympic Games when he was younger. And he's a nut for track and field. He would not, we were literally being introduced, and he was asking me about South African track and field athletes and Sydney Marie and all this stuff. Great company. And so I would have, that's a guy I would have loved to go for dinner with, have some beers.
I was going to say, if you had to choose your 5 people for dinner, he'd obviously be.
I think now he would be. I've been lucky. Like, I mean, I'd put David Epstein and him on it as well, because I think I could just, that would be like having two.
You wouldn't get a word in edgeways.
Yeah, that would be like having two, I don't know, nuclear reactors next to one another. And
it's
just
two,
like,
heavyweight champions against each other, very smart heavyweight champions.
That would be very interesting. So Gladwell's first question to the panel, he says, let's do this from very simple premise. I'm a Martian and I've come to Earth, and I want to know why, when I look at sports, I see two races. Explain to me why I see two Olympic finals, two Wimbledon titles, and so on. So that's a, if you break force yourself to that, answer that question, that gets you off on the right foot. It's good. And then his main question to us was, and he says he likes this idea of magic wand experiments. It makes you think about something. He says, if you had a magic wand that could dispel any boundaries of physics and time and physiology and ethics in this case, what's the one experiment you would do to resolve this question? And he puts that to all three panelists. And mine was, and I mean, so the biggest problem we have here is we have all this physiology, and I've explained the 13 studies and what they show and what that means. But it is a limitation that we don't have it on truly elite males. You know, Leah Thomas, as I mentioned, was a good I think 500th in the US in the one event, 32nd in another. That's a good swimmer. In the US, if you're in the top 500 in the US, you're good. Never mind the top 50.
Yeah.
But it's not great. It's not Caleb Dressel and Michael Phelps level. Mm-hmm. So that's someone in the top 3% making the switch. What you want is top 1%, mm-hmm. and then see what happens to women's sports. So my magic wand experiment was, you go to the four big team competitions around the world that have good women's equivalents. NBA paired with the women's NBA. England football compared with women's Premier League. England Premier League rugby compared with women's Premier 15s. And the Aussie rules football, where there's also a fairly well-developed women's one. Mm. And, of course, the Olympic Games. So you've got five competitions. At random, you sneak testosterone-suppressing drugs into everyone's toothpaste. the males only, right?
Yeah.
Remember, you've got a magic wand. You can do this. You magically make 50% of those males suppress their testosterone without their knowledge. That's really key, because the moment this person knows, all subsequent performance is affected by knowledge. That's why the lab studies on this are not going to be reliable moving forward. Then what you do is, because you know, it's not double blinded, you know which males are now altered compared to unaltered. You've got your suppressed T males and your normal T males. You take your suppressed T males and you bleed them into the women's competition. So you let all those suppressed T-males play women's NBA for a season, play women's Premier 15 rugby, play women's Premier League soccer and women's AFL. And your theory is that if that T-suppression works, within one or two seasons, 50% of that women's competition will now be biological female and 50% will be altered males. That makes sense, right?
Yes.
Because you will achieve a new equilibrium with a larger pool. Right. Now, that would have pushed women aside, because if there were, let's say, across all those competitions, there were 1,000 biological females. There'll now only be 500. Mm-hmm. So 500 would have lost out. And you can argue that that's unfair. But again, magic wand. Mm. All I'm interested in is, do we get 50% parity in the women's NBA or not? Mm. And the answer is, my theory is that I think we'd be lucky to see any woman left at all. In basketball, I reckon 90 to 95% of what remains will be those altered males.
Yeah.
In rugby, it'll be the same. In soccer, maybe slightly less, because height's not as important. There's more space on the field. It's not as much a contact sport. More distance running. You know, they're covering like 10, 11K in a game. Maybe there you could get away with 80-20 split, and then AFL will be back to normal. But all the others, and then the Olympic Games, no finalists will be women.
Mm.
They'll be biological males. And that would be the experiment that would seal the argument, in my opinion.
When you raised that question, I kind of thought, what would I do if I was a sports scientist? But it would be close to that.
Mm.
You know, it's almost finding that. And I think the ultimate experiment is to, and I guess the only way that support of transgender women in sport actually works is if subsequent studies come out that prove that there is no physical advantage. But
correct.
We haven't just talked, I mean, we've talked obviously about testosterone, but we can't just measure, as you said, on testosterone. Mm-hmm. It's everything from bloods to bones.
Correct.
And until all those levels become the same within the normal range of women, that's almost impossible.
Yeah. And so you just do this massive ecological experiment where you take 50% of the males, you knock their T out without them knowing it, and you bleed them in, and you see if you reach a new equilibrium that looks like fair towards women. Now, it's still not fair, because it still means that 75% of the world's male sporting population is competing for 50% of the spaces of women's. Whereas, and you're still displacing women. And you can make arguments around social elements and so on. But anyways, the point is that study would answer the physiology, and then we could take it from there. But even the way you just spoke now is, you're arguing it from the point of view that until you have evidence that shows that it's removed, you should have women's space closed to biological males.
Yeah.
That seems so logical and rational to me. Other people are arguing the opposite. They say until you have evidence that it's unfair, you should let them in. And this is how we differ so fundamentally. There's not even dialogue. It's very frustrating. Anyway, let's draw a line under that one.
Yeah, anyway. So those of you, of course, I'm sure Ross has been looking on his Twitter and doesn't want to engage in more debate around this issue, but I'm sure there are lots of people with lots of different opinions, and we'd obviously like to hear from you if you have something that you feel has any value in this space, because there is obviously an ongoing debate. So Ross, I mean, you were there, and that was obviously why you were there, to take part in this particular talk. But what other talks were there? Were there interesting stuff that you attended as just an attendee?
Interesting, but different from what I anticipated. I remember hearing about the Sloan Conference 5 or 6 years ago, friend of mine who used to be an analyst with the South African Sevens rugby team told me about this unbelievable analysis conference in the US. It's like the pinnacle of sports science and analysis. So I was really excited for that reason. So I go along to this hoping, A, to meet Gladwell, B, to do well in the debate, neither of which really happened. So two out of two, there's two strikes.
You still met him.
I did. I mean, yeah, but...
even if it was short.
I went to that beer and track and field gossip. Objective three was to network and to meet people who work in sports science and so on. So I go along, they have a speakers function on the first night, and off I go, and I'm going to network now, and I introduce myself to a guy. What do you do? I tell him, and he says, he returns the answer. He says, I work for a company that does data analytics for NFL teams. Oh, that's really interesting. Tell me more. So is that about how the coaches get data off the field and then manage and analyze? No, not really. We're more on the ticketing side of the business and how they target their ticket sales to different potential customer bases and how they manage the sponsorship deals and the in-house business strategy. I said, okay, that's not really my domain. Nice meeting you.
So in that case, it sounds like more business.
It's extremely
data
business
than it is about sport.
Next guy I'm with, I'm having dinner now with him. I say, what do you do? And he works for Ticketmaster. And they're doing the same thing. They're using data analytics to try and track people's ticket buying behaviors on this primary and secondary market so that they can better manage ticket sales for teams. Third person I met was in a think tank working on NCAA strategy around sponsorship, because as you may know, that NCAA never used to allow athletes to commercialize their images and make money as college athletes. And that's changing now. Now that's really interesting. So that's an interesting person, but not science.
Yes.
So I still haven't met a scientist. Mm. Anyway, next day the conference begins and it's very much the same thing. It's just dominated by NFTs and Bitcoin and gambling.
Business. Now, NFTs, I saw this yesterday by some pure chance.
Non-fungible tokens.
Fungible tokens.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what they are? I mean, I'm sure you do, but I don't understand what they are.
I increased my knowledge by 5,000% thanks to Boston, but I still know nothing.
Mm.
I can tell you that on the very first session of the whole conference was two guys, Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V calls himself, and Michael Rubin, both very successful businessmen. Gary V wants to own the New York Jets. Michael Rubin already owns part of the Philadelphia 76ers. Sports nuts, authors, tech entrepreneurs. And they both said that if you aren't on, this is their words, not mine, right? Please don't blame me when you lose your money. They both said, if you're not on the NFT thing, you are the same now as someone who missed the dot-com opportunities in the 1990s. They said that where we are now is where we were in the 1990s, read dot-coms and the internet. A lot of people went crazy, bought stupid, lost money, but a lot of people really capitalized. That's what NFTs and Bitcoin and crypto are going to do right now for the world of
sport. This is particularly in American sport.
So far. I mean, I know it's, for instance, I know Los Angeles Lakers sold the naming rights to their stadium. It used to be the Staples Center. It's now crypto.com arena or stadium. $700 million deal. I mean, massive money coming into sport from these companies, which is the same as when it was the 90s. I didn't pay attention back then. I was still in school. But remember in the 90s, there were all those companies that had so much money. They were just flinging it around.
Yeah, all the dot-coms. Yeah.
And that bubble burst eventually. Mm. But some survived it. And that seems to be their impression. So as I understand it, they're basically digital trading cards and collectibles.
Okay.
And Michael Rubin said to the audience, he said, if you guys aren't already owners of NFTs, go away and get on this now. Now, okay, he's got an incentive to do that because I think his company might be making money off of it. But
fascinating.
That was interesting. But I don't know enough to even critically assess what they're saying. I want to look this up, foreign to me.
It is. And I think, you know, for those of you listening, I mean, we know the majority of our listeners are in the UK and the US. You know, they're obviously dotted around the world, but a lot of listeners in that space. And if you know what NFTs are and how they operate, you know, let us know, because it is an interesting space. Like, you know, I remember reading the fact that Facebook announced that they're going to allow NFTs, and I had to spend a bit of time looking that up. But it's around these tokens. So, yeah, fascinating. Because it's all about, I mean, to some extent, the data of sport lends itself to how sport is marketed
in many ways. Yeah.
So
there was a presentation in Boston where they'd used machine learning and robots and cameras to track fan movement around the stadium on game day. So they knew 3 hours before kickoff where fans would be, 2 hours before, 1 hour before, 30 minutes in half time, exactly where they were going so they could better target where to sell them things and where to put their gambling kiosks and whatever else. Like, it's unbelievable. But that's what the conference is.
It's almost the science of the business of sport.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's massively data analytic driven. I went to a session that was done by the head analyst for the Los Angeles Lakers. I thought, this will be interesting. He spoke for 30 minutes without saying a thing. Because they don't want to give away. They don't want to give away the secrets, right? He's not going to share with us the analysis that took the Lakers to the NBA title in that bubble in 2020. Right? I mean, why would he do that? So instead, he presented generic stuff like, if you're a data analyst, you have to translate the numbers into words for the coach. I mean, yeah, and you know, don't use slides with more than 4 bullet points. For instance, was one of his tips.
He's talking to students.
But the thing is, no, he's talking to professionals.
Yeah, but it sounds like he's talking to students. Yeah.
And
yeah.
The thing is, though, I'm saying this, he was actually really impressive. Mm-hmm. He gave me the impression that he's hell of a good at what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he did mention in passing when I used to be at Merrill Lynch. So that was his previous job. He was involved somehow in trading and finance and investment management and so on. And so that's the caliber of person who's now, when I did a little bit of work for Arsenal Football Club 3 years ago, and they'd also employed a computer programmer who was a physicist and had two PhDs. And I know other teams have got physics guys, computer programmers, engineers. The world, it made me realize coming back from Boston that if I was now an 18, 19-year-old kid wanting to go into elite sports and high performance, my best bet would be to go into data and analytics and computational modeling and some kind of machine learning, artificial intelligence.
So, I mean, explain
how I'm a dinosaur now.
So, in other words, when you talk about that, how does it differ from what sports scientists did to what they do now?
When I started,
you're suggesting it's changed a lot.
Yeah, when I started, my tools were a treadmill and a VO2 oxygen sensing machine, give you a mask, put you on a treadmill or an indoor bicycle. Measure some blood samples, maybe take a biopsy if I was feeling adventurous, and test 15 people in a good study. I mean, that's what we did. My PhD, my first ever research study was 15 participants in an environmental chamber on an indoor bike measuring core and skin temperature, heart rate, and RPE. That was it. Now I'm looking at it and thinking, okay, these guys now have access to 30,000 people's data through Fitbit and Whoop and Oura Ring and all these other different methods that they can use. And they are programmers and engineers. The World Rugby at the moment, one of the big projects I'm involved in is a mouth guard study. We've given elite men, women, young 13-year-old, 15-year-old, 18-year-old players mouth guards to play with. And they've got these
smart mouth guards, aren't
they? They're instrumented with a little accelerometer that is very accurately able to capture linear and rotational accelerations of the head so that we can, for the first time, accurately quantify head load during rugby.
Sure, that is extraordinary.
I sit on these meetings and I'm like, are you guys finished yet? Because I don't understand what you've been talking about for 10 minutes.
But I mean, you can have all the data you like. You've got to understand what that means in terms of performance at the end of the day.
So on the interpretation side and the application, I still feel like, okay, I'm adding some value. But but I mean, the point is they're engineers. And they are functioning down a very deep hole that I've only ever looked down. They're at the bottom of. So they're burrowed into this one topic and they are experts in this one thing in the same way that, so it's like David Epstein's book Range, and there's a theory about hedgehogs and foxes where hedgehogs know one big thing and foxes know lots of little things. Sports science seems to me to be a place now for more hedgehogs than ever before. Very, very knowledgeable people about one thing, and it's driven so much by tools.
But you still need your foxes to bring all that specific knowledge into a space which
essentially
adds performance.
I suppose the danger is that it'll oscillate like a pendulum, swing maybe from one side to the next, is that we get proposals at World Rugby for funding from research, and honestly, half of them now involve some kind of quote-unquote big data. We're going to take thousands upon thousands of data points, and we're going to do machine learning, we're going to model and develop some computational model, or I forget even the name of the word now, it's slipped my mind, that's how little I understand these things sometimes. And that's where sports science is now. If I was an undergraduate with ambitions of a PhD in sports science, and I wasn't doing IT, computer science, some kind of statistical in-depth stuff, not just the basic stats I did, I would be very worried that I'm not only heading in the right direction.
So if you're a young sports science student, you need to keep an eye on that.
Yeah. I mean, five years ago, is it
about advancement in this space, or is there any disadvantage to the fact that everything is focused around data now? I mean, is there any reason why it shouldn't go down that road?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean,
the reason why I ask this is because when we talk about traditional science, VO2 maxes, being on a machine,
the sports science,
you potentially take away heart and mind and mental and that sort of thing, because it becomes about facts rather than, for instance, if you go and do a run or at a race, you can run a 5K in a race always faster than you can do in training because of the environment and the psychological
most
factors.
Most people outperform their lab performance.
So does data not allow for outliers, for instance?
I suppose it depends what you're measuring, because the one thing we do have now, and like COVID threw up a lot of studies on this, is because all of a sudden you had Fitbit, Oura Ring, Whoop. Even yesterday, one came out, a big medical aid and provider from South Africa is called Discovery, and they run a rewards program where you get fitness, you get points for fitness and training at the gym, and that can be used to buy coffees inside every week. And so these companies have now started to analyze their data to understand COVID outcomes. So you're going to get 600,000 people who'd uploaded their Strava files, and 200,000 people whose Fitbit data was obtained, and they knew of those 200,000 how many got COVID, and then they can track before and after what's the heart rate variability in those people with COVID, and did they return to normal functional activity within 1 week, 2 weeks, 6 months, one year? So fascinating stuff. Now, that's real life.
Yeah.
That's data collection that's happening without the need for deliberate data collection, you know? It's incidental. That stuff would be more valid than any lab study.
Yeah.
Noisier, but certainly more valid. So there's opportunities that big data presents. And I don't know what the downsides of it are, other than that it's, you know, there's a danger with big data that you create models that are in effect circular. No model is perfect, you know. The model is only as good as its input variables and then how they're interpreted by the model to produce some outcome. And when you test 60,000 people, how do you account for individual variation? So I suppose there's always a danger there that you start to lose sight of the parts of the whole.
Yeah.
But in theory, if you're doing it well, that's the whole point, is you can analyze parts of the whole.
Yeah.
Machine learning and predictions and algorithms that anticipate future better than any scientist person in a lab ever could. So it's a super fast changing space, really. There was a session in Boston, by the way, on endurance analytics and data, which isn't quite as far as advanced. And one of the speakers there was Alan Lim, who is known for many things. One of them was one of the sort of founders of PowerTap, because it was one of the first guys who figured out actually cyclists missing data.
One of the first power meters commercially available.
Yeah, exactly. Super expensive compared to what is available now, but they opened the door to data for cyclists more than just how fast am I going and how far have I gone. And he's now with Scratch Labs, I think, they do the nutrition. And then there was two others. One of them was Kira D'Amato, who's the new marathon record holder for the US, speaking as an athlete about data. That puts all her stuff on Strava, is pretty open about data. And she was saying that once she moved to smartwatches that were able to measure stride length and contact time and so on, it gave her data that was interesting. But it didn't, I'd be very surprised if it changed her training. So I sort of cheekily asked the question at that session, and this is something to think about, is if you took the best tech available to us in the Western world and you dumped it into Kenya, into the Great Rift Valley for 6 months, and they knew how to use it, so you could show them how to use it and interpret it the way we do, how much faster would they be in the marathon?
Well, I suppose the question is, you can look at, I always think the best example is looking at how events and times have progressed in the last 20 years. So for instance, for many, many years, the Ironman record in Hawaii was held, I think, by Dave Scott or Mark Allen. I think it might have been Mark Allen, which was 8 hours and 3 minutes. And for almost two decades, that time didn't change, despite the fact that there was so much more information coming into that space. There was better bikes that you could buy, all sorts of things. But yet that time still maintained and still ranks as one of the fastest times ever. So my argument would be, and I was just thinking of this question while you were talking about this, how much of a difference does this vast amount of knowledge actually going to make to the end performance?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, then you look at the Ironman now and you've got how many guys going way under 8 hours?
Yes, you have now, yes. But it took a long time to get there.
And what's driving that? What's making the best 3 or 4 cyclists in the world so fast right now?
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading a piece the other day where Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet were saying they were riding the same part, but they've been riding for the last 4 or 5 years and they're being shelled out the back of the first climb.
Yeah. Well, you have to be born in Slovenia.
That's one requirement, is you have to have that blood cell, the Slovenian blood cells. But anyway, the marathon running's gone off the charts, in part because of the shoe, but no one knows yet still how much of the improvements, the shoe versus maybe some other things.
But there's no doubt the shoe has had an impact.
There's no doubt the shoe's had an impact.
Yes, we do know because, that.
And one of the things Malcolm Gladwell and I were talking about before going on stage is in college running and high school running in the US, the number of sub-4-minute miles is just unbelievable this year. I saw a stat saying that in the last 5 or 6 years, it's been between 30 and 38, average of 32. This year, 90. I mean, it's like...
And that must be to do with shoes.
Well, you can't make an argument they're all doping.
No.
A handful, maybe. How do you get from 38 to 90? It can only be shoes.
That's a good data study on its own, isn't it?
Yeah, that would be really interesting.
That would be if you were able to figure out what shoes they were wearing all the time and then what brand they were wearing. Right. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. So I asked that question and Kira D'Amato, it was quite an interesting answer. She said... Probably the top doesn't get much faster, but instead of 5 out of 50 becoming elite athletes, 10 out of 50 do.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way to look at it. Couldn't disagree. Alan Lim sort of looked at the ceiling for 5 seconds, made sort of faces for a while, and said 2 to 3%, which is interesting. So he's saying that the average elite Kenyan, which is a oxymoron, the typical elite Kenyan who's running 2:04 is going to run 2:01. That's 3%
more or less. The best science.
With the best, not science necessarily, but devices, smart devices, data devices.
Well, so, that's suggesting that they're not doing that already.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He's saying Kipchoge is going to run under 2 in a legal, proper race, not a contrived stage managed thing. So, I don't know. Listeners can let us know what you think. I'd be surprised if it was 1%. And that's the point being that I think all that data that we use and so on could be a hindrance for a lot of people, because I think physiology is actually quite amazing. And if you learn to listen to it, it does the same job as the data, but better.
To wrap things up a little bit here, it's something maybe we can get into a podcast sometime later about creating your own data study of yourself. And for those of you that are on Strava, I'm fascinated when I look at a time, a particular climb. And if I've done a PR, I then look back at all the times that I've done 20 or 30 times, and I try and figure out what my average time is. Now, none of the data points of that is that average number.
Yes.
But it's either side of the number all the way through. So average is a very weird way of measuring something. But if you can say that 50% of your times are above that average, and none of it necessarily works. And there's lots of ways you can look at it. You can say age has had an effect on how fast or slow I am at that climb. My level of fitness has all those sort of things. There's millions of different things you can do. But data it's quite fun. I mean, you enjoy data yourself.
So I got power pedals.
Aha. I knew you were going to buy those.
For this exact reason. Because now I can actually look at the numbers while I'm riding. After I've gone on 3 rides now, nearly killed myself a few times. I've gone through red lights. I've nearly gone past intersections and overshot corners because I'm like Chris Frooming my way around the peninsula, just looking at my stem. But it's fascinating, and it's really interesting to use intuition guided by data. So that's where it's... So for example, we have a typical wind in the Cape in this time of year, and it's from the south. And if you're riding into it versus with it, what's the effort level and the speed and so on? And now with power output, I can quantify what's obvious to me in the first place.
Yeah.
Because I'm going slowly here and I'm working hard, headwind. Yeah. I'm going fast here and I'm not working at all, tailwind. But now I can actually give a number to that. and I can get less depressed at how slowly I'm going because I know the power is actually normal, but the wind is the reason. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Now that's now we're talking basic level here, yes, to illustrate the concept.
But ideally, what I would do if I was you is I wouldn't look at the power numbers until I got home and be able to look whether there was a difference when I was riding into a wind versus riding home,
yeah,
with the wind behind me. The argument is in cycling, I'm digressing slightly here, yeah, is that if you're riding into it, psychologically you feel it's harder, but you've got to remind yourself that you probably pull back a bit out of your brain going, this is going to be hard, therefore I need to pace myself differently.
Well, I'll tell you the answer to that right away is I produce much more power into the wind because I don't want to slow down.
But did you do that before the power meter?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I would have, because my heart rate used to be similarly like way, way high, right, into the wind. So
interesting.
Anyway, the point is that you can start quantifying
it. You can dot it. Great fun.
And if you quantify it with the correct intuition in a systematic way, then the data becomes very important and meaningful positively. But if you quantify it with biases, then you actually can apply the wrong lessons from the data, and then it becomes counterproductive. And that's where the data conversation is quite interesting. So it would be very interesting to speak to someone from a company that does these smart devices and have them explain, like, what are the pitfalls of what they do? Because I think that's probably a bold assertion. Many people have invested in analytics and data and gotten worse because they're not applying it in the correct way. And if we could have a conversation to fix that, that would be quite handy. I mean, what I've just spoken about, the power thing, is sort of semi-jokey, basic stuff. But there's some important concepts in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good point. And we definitely need to maybe look at, say, how to analyze your own sports data down the line and to use it correctly, because there is so much technology in sport at the moment available to everybody that's out there doing any kind of sport. And I'm sure there's an opportunity for everybody, whether you're a cyclist or a runner or play squash or racquetball or tennis, you know, that the research is out there and you can download it onto your smartwatch. So it's just about understanding what it's about. Anyway, I think it's great to wrap up, and I think it must have been a great trip to be involved in, but we're going to be getting in hopefully a couple of interviews in the next couple of weeks. We are very much hoping we're going to get Jim Walmsley onto this podcast, and I tell you, we've had some trouble just coordinating our time zones with Jim at the moment, and we're just following on with Jim after our month in February talking a lot about endurance. So we're hoping that in the next couple of weeks we're going to have Jim Walmsley on our podcast to talk about his life as an ultra-distance runner. But until then, for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.